Welcome to the latest edition of the IDEA podcast from the Irish Development Education Association. I'm your host, Emma Green, and today's episode features the second panel session from our virtual conference, Global Citizenship and Inequality in 2021, Forging a New Path. We have four wonderful speakers exploring the questions, given the reality of the current situation, what will it take to forge a new path built on equality? COVID has shown us how essential global solidarity is, but how can we keep that sense of global citizenship alive? And what is the role for global citizenship education in supporting a rights-based recovery that ensures equality for all? The panel is moderated by Dr. Eilish Gillen, who is head of the Department of International Development at Maynooth University. I hope you enjoy.
Thanks to IDEA for inviting me to chair the panel this morning on such an important topic. What is it going to take, or what's required to forge a new path built on equality? And unfortunately, I wasn't able to participate in yesterday's session, but I did listen back to the podcast of it. And I was really moved by all the incredibly powerful and challenging points that were made about inequality and equality in our world, many of which have been amplified by the pandemic. Everything from Richard's points about understanding inequality as a social relationship and its profound effects on all aspects of life, on trust, on global solidarity, to Kathleen's powerful analysis of capitalism and neoliberalism as the dominant ideology of our time, and her emphasis on capitalism and neoliberalism and its ethics of competition, accumulation, aggrandizement, and exploitation. All of those in themselves are massive, massive challenges. And she reminded us that we can't be naive to assume that power will just be given from the elite and the rich to those who are oppressed or marginalized within society, that it has to be challenged, it has to be taken, it has to have an alternative politics, a politics based much more on equality, human rights, justice. And I think this really sends a really powerful message to us as global citizenship educators, a message which was reinforced by Lillian's challenging account of the effects of COVID in a Kenyan context, and by Mary and Martin, who highlighted the importance of acknowledging, understanding, and redressing the reversal of human rights for people, persons with disabilities and ethnic minorities, travellers and Roma, which have been exacerbated during the pandemic. So I felt that the speakers yesterday gave us a very strong sense of the multiple kind of equality challenges that we face. And while on the one hand this presents itself as very challenging for global citizenship educators, it also kind of gives us an understanding of the context in which we work and asks us to ask questions about what kind of a role can we play, what kind of understanding is necessary in order to challenge these inequalities, to enable people to call out, to demand, to move beyond their kind of individual or our individual needs and senses of responsibility to a much more kind of active global citizenship and solidarity based on equality and justice. What kinds of critical pedagogies do we need? Processes of listening and understanding. And these are only some of the questions which our panel today are going to address in much more, in-depth ways than I can do here. So I'm really delighted to introduce the panel. We have four really interesting, experienced speakers who will come at this question of the role of global citizenship education in forging a path of equality from different perspectives. So I'd like to start, if I may, with Amitabh Bihar, who's the CEO of Oxfam India and Vice Chair of Civicus. And Amitabh will speak about the experience of COVID-19 in India and what can be done to tackle inequality and to build citizen participation, particularly the role of civil society. So I'd like to hand over to you now, Amitabh.
Many thanks, Eilish. And thank you. Delighted to be back with our friends and comrades at IDEA. Thank you, Frank, for inviting me. Let me just start and get straight into the questions that we are discussing. And I must say, Alish, the summary from yesterday was powerful and very helpful for me to build on and probably take some of those points further. We are discussing 21, but it's been an absolutely devastating year. It is an absolutely unprecedented year. And certainly in India, we were hit by the COVID wave in a way which we've not experienced globally. The country completely collapsed. 1 billion people collapsed. We lost, according to probably all estimates, more than 1 million people. And people were literally dying on the streets, dying, waiting at the car parks, waiting at the hospital lobby, not being able to get a hospital bed or oxygen or the basic medicines. It's been a very, very tough time for all of us. And you know, I think what's important, what I wanted to say is what we saw was still deaths were not because of COVID. Probably some of them were because of COVID and the virus. It was more because we were our health system was overwhelmed. We were not able to even provide basic oxygen. And then the this has had a double whammy. On the one hand, people dying of COVID. And on the other hand, there are estimates which are saying almost 250 million people have either already or are sliding back into below poverty. So this has been such a heart-wrenching time for all of us. But what I wanted to say is that this is also the time when we were looking at another story unfolding. And that story is just to take from our Oxfam report, I want to give you two data points. One, that just during the pandemic, the top 10 billionaires added $500 billion to their wealth. $500 billion. And on the other hand, poor across the world slided into poverty. They found it extremely difficult to even get bread onto their table. So this was the stark inequality we were looking at. I just talked of the health system in India. The top 11 billionaires in India, and we are taking 11 because there was a tie at number 10, they gained so much wealth just during the pandemic that they could have supported or funded the entire Indian health ministry for 10 years. That's the level of inequality we're looking at. And I just wanted to, you know, this obscene inequality that we look at is, I think, the real story. And as the Secretary General of UN said, and I really liked his phrase, that COVID has been like an X-ray, which has exposed the inequalities we live with, the racism that we live with, the patriarchy that we live with, you know, and that's what COVID has done. So I just wanted to, you know, but COVID is a reminder. It is a reminder of the failure of the systems that we have created. It is a symptom of the systems we have created. But let me just, you know, I think it's very important for us to also bring in one more aspect, because this COVID story, the inequality story, would be incomplete without another dimension that I want to bring in. Or maybe just before that, to situate that, the whole conversation around neoliberalism. I'm glad that it's been discussed, but how the neoliberal model in the last 20, 30 years has actually, post-Washington consensus, has actually increased inequality to mammoth proportions. So that's something I wanted to bring in. But in the last few years, in a decade, we are also living in extremely difficult times. And I'll just give you some names, starting from Bolsonaro to Erdogan, to Modi, to Duterte, to Trump. Fortunately, at least this year, we have seen the back of Trump. But this is what we are facing. I think this is a massive challenge. The post-World War consensus around, say, UDHR, I think UDHR was probably the most important document for many of us. And the normative framework of what the world should look like is clearly reflected in that UDHR. That's in shambles. What we are seeing is populism, demagogy, shrinking of the civic space, huge assault on human rights. So that's the context we are living in. And I wanted to bring that also, because COVID is so massive that in the last 1 year, we've not adequately talked about it. But I think without discussing this, we'll not be able to get out of the place where we are in. So I just wanted to say this is very clear with both these two big, one on the hand, COVID, which is, as I'm saying, a symptom of the systems that we have created, of neoliberalism, and now this complete breakdown of the normative consensus also, is clear, making it clear for us that we need to reboot ourselves. And that rebooting is the path ahead I wanted to talk of. And in that, I would say that there are four things I just wanted to do, and I'll be fairly quick. A complete reboot of economy and society, and particularly for the idea of global citizenship, the idea for a group like IDEA is critical. So let me just say four things. One, but just a context that global citizenship needs to be brought back to the idea of citizenship, which is in the context of democracy, of liberal values, of pluralism, without which it will not work. Four specific ideas. First, I do think that we have done a disservice by not linking development adequately with politics. I would say development has to be seen as part of politics, not the other way around. I feel hugely uncomfortable, and that's a challenge to all of us. Moving ahead, politics is development. These are not two different streams. We'll have to see that as integrated. The second, we will need to look at fundamentally challenging the idea of what is development. Development built on exploitation of Mother Earth, of unjust orders, is not all right. We need to, the climate change is telling us it's not going to work, it's not sustainable. We need to fundamentally relook at small is beautiful, and there could be several alternatives. Third, I think markets are something that we have let go of rather comfortably. We engage with the state, but we don't adequately challenge the markets. Markets need to be held accountable. They need to function with not, capitalism the way it is. At least they need to move to stakeholder capitalism. And just finally, we need to go back not just to the values of global citizenship in terms of looking at equality and freedom, but I think we did not invest enough time on fraternity and justice. So I would say these are the third pillar openly talked of fraternity, but we've not done that. Fraternity and justice have to be the cornerstone of moving ahead. Thank you.
Excellent, Amitabh. Thanks very much. And thanks for looking after your own time. Really huge points there towards the end about, as you say, rebooting, and those four key kind of points that you make about the need to link development with politics, questioning development that's exploitative and kind of the small is beautiful idea, challenging the markets and linking fraternity to justice. So all of this in the context of, as you describe it, the devastating year that we have all had, and from your point of view and in what you've talked about in the context of India, and the whole point about COVID putting an X-ray on existing inequalities and the systems which have been constructed around all of that. And hopefully we'll be able to explore all of this in greater detail as in our discussion later on. So thanks very much for that. I'll move on quickly, if it's okay, then to Eric, and welcome Eric Ehige, who's political coordinator at Black and Irish and host of the Engaging with Eric podcast. And Eric will speak to what can be done to support equality and solidarity, particularly in relation to tackling systemic racism. So thanks very much again for joining us, Eric, and over to you.
Yeah, thank you so much for allowing me to speak at the conference. It's an absolute pleasure. And the remarks made previously were quite riveting. It's just so great to be here, and it's fantastic to know that IDEA are doing such fantastic work in the area of global citizenship, which I think is needed now more than ever, which I hope to delve a bit deeper into in my opening remarks. Firstly, I want to start by saying I earnestly believe we're living at a time of revolutionary, we're living in revolutionary times when it comes to the cultural attitudes of people towards societal issues. And I think these revolutionary cultural attitudes are particularly embodied by today's young people. And I think we've seen this over the past year or so. The past year is undeniably a testament to that. There's a plethora of different social issues that currently confront us, be it global poverty, the mistreatment of human beings due to immutable characteristics that they possess, which are out of their control, endless wars that are cutting lives short before it gets the chance to blossom, poverty, corruption, the list, and this list is far from exhaustive. Many of us have a feeling of disdain when it comes to this reality of flagrant suffering and agony for a significant portion of humans within the world. Notwithstanding, as was mentioned by the prior speaker and the previous speaker, the forthcoming impacts of climate change, which is something that I think is instilling and bestowing a deep sense of angst and fear, and injecting a deep sense of fear into a lot of young people. I think some of us, for some of us, this reality presents, it's bittersweet, you know, this reality of pain and suffering. Bitter in the sense that the likes of the people here at this conference have to confront these issues on a day-to-day basis and consider how they can bring about a fruitful and sustainable, holistic change for those who are victims of these social problems. And, you know, this can lead to a lot of consequences for the people that want to confront these issues, because you have to, you know, take on the onus, the burden, the responsibility of shouldering all that comes with facing the agony and misery out there in the world for those who are less fortunate. But I think it's sweet in a sense also, because you see yourself playing your part in bettering the world for those who are less fortunate. And I honestly believe there is no greater spiritual dividend than confronting issues on behalf of those who do not have the privilege to be able to stand up and do so in a forthright way as we do. So I think there's something very sweet about it also. I think moving on, that, you know, at the time we live in right now, with all the social problems that exist, why I think it's a very pivotal revolutionary time is for two reasons. Number one, because of the state of the moral zeitgeist, as it's called. Martin Luther King Jr. has a quote that says the arc of history slowly tilts towards justice. And I think right now, as we can see from the activities of a lot of young people and a lot of people generally, to address the problems that exist in the world, vis-a-vis the Black Lives Matter movement, vis-a-vis the Fridays for Future movement, the arc of morality, that we're, its current state right now, I think it embodies, it implores all of us to want to stand up and tackle a lot of the issues that people face. But I think another thing that really shapes the moral climate today, as I've insinuated previously, is young people and the actions that a lot of youth are taking to confront a lot of the issues that exist in the world. And I think this presents a very ripe, encouraging opportunity for us to stand up and confront problems. When it comes to youth culture today, activism has seeped into the culture. And now it is nearly inextricable to be an activist if you're a young person. There's an appreciation for activism and getting involved in tackling the world's problem and playing your role as a global citizen, embracing your stake in this world with a collective consciousness to help those who are marginalized and less fortunate. And I think this is quite a beautiful thing, and something that we undeniably need to embrace. In this speech of mine, the opening remarks, I'm not going to contend that the issues that exist that I've pointed to earlier, poverty, corruption and the like, are going to evaporate overnight due to the moral state of the universe, of the world, of our species. Even though we've made considerable progress over the past century when it comes to tackling a lot of these problems, I cannot say that they're going to evaporate overnight. But I will say that with the impetus that I think the current state of the world embodies, we can really grasp onto that and use it to do a lot of good. Here, maybe where we're situated, where I'm situated here in Ireland, when things are bad in a lot of senses in terms of the healthcare system and the like, but good in a lot of senses relative to where my mother would come from, for example, let's say Nigeria. Now, there's a lot we can do to spark the consciousness of people here to allow them to embrace the fact that they, when one is denied rights anywhere in the world, when one is treated to in a detrimental way, it also impacts me, irregardless of where I'm situated. The institution of slavery, I think, was abolished because of the fact that this epiphany, this realization was sparked across the world when people saw themselves in the slave, they saw themselves in the people that are being oppressed. And I think Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights leaders of the 60s in the United States of America did a phenomenal job in allowing people to open their minds and hearts to see that they are bound with the people that are being mistreated. Those who are privileged and well off, those who are white in America, who were privileged in the legal system in that country and by the culture and cultural and societal context within America, were able to realize that those who were being mistreated, they were bound to those people in some way, in one way or another, and then allowed them to make the necessary concessions to allow the people who were being mistreated to be able to grasp onto their rights through the fights and the toil, the activist related fights and toil that those people had to endure and commit to. So I think appealing, before I close, I'd like to implore all of us in what we do to appeal to a higher, deeper, transcendental message of our common humanity. It's not only been embodied by the likes of Martin Luther King, but the likes of Daniel O'Connell here in Ireland, who at a time of slavery in the United States of America saw a lot of Black people in America being mistreated and spoke of how he as an Irishman was not willing to stand idly by and allow people to be mistreated, because anywhere in the world where oppression occurs, where people are being degradingly treated to because of immutable characteristics, he was going to stand out and speak out against it. So I think being able to appeal to this transcendental message is incredibly important. Gandhi championed it in India, and I think it's something that we need to do. And I think this definitely presents an introspective challenge for a lot of us who work on the inside to do good work for people who are vulnerable. Yes, we have to work to open the minds and hearts of people to allow them to appreciate their role, their responsibility as global citizens. But sometimes we need to look introspectively too, but to be able to see, as Martin Luther King did, that those sometimes who are not committed to the right thing, those who are not committed to changing the world, we have a responsibility to try and change those people also, to help them realize their role. Martin Luther King took it to such an extreme extent where he stated that the white supremacists, the Ku Klux Klan in America, who of course vehemently hate him as a Black man, and the people that look like him and want to wipe them off the face of the earth, they too are his brothers, but they just don't realize that they're his brothers. And one day they will. And the racism and the discrimination that they uphold, they think is a blemish with me, but actually it's a deep spiritual blemish with them. And it's their responsibility to realize this. And he played a role in converting many of the civil rights leaders of the day, the spiritual psyche and moral consciousness of people at that time, because he was committed to fighting for the vulnerable, uplifting the vulnerable, but also winning over those who did not see the right way. And I think we as activists, we as people who want to do good in the world, need to have a vehement commitment to those who are vulnerable, but also a commitment to those who are vulnerable and don't realize they're vulnerable. In other words, those who are committed to the wrong ideologies and the wrong things. Because a lot of people, due to the inequalities that we're speaking about, are being seeped by wrong elements, by wrong, I think, persuasions that appeal to the human condition and the human psyche and our emotional inclinations to draw us into the wrong way of thinking. It's quite appealing when you think about it. I'm reading James Baldwin's book, The Fire Next Time, and he's talking about an interaction that he had with a racist in America, a kind of militant group in America. It was a racist and a Black militant group in America. And when it came to the Black militant group that he interacted with, their whole concept of righting the wrongs that existed in America were to replace the image of the white God with the Black God. It's the Nation of Islam, if many of you might be aware of this group. It's a group Malcolm X was once a part of. And they were committed to the idea that the white man in America was the devil. This is what they believed. Why they believed it is because of the mistreatment of Black people in America for so long. In the book, James Baldwin talks about how he interacted with some white people, a Black militant group in America known as the Nation of Islam. And they were aggrieved, naturally, because of the mistreatment of Black people in America, as anyone would. Any oppressed group would be angry with the fact that for centuries, a particular people, because of characteristics they possess that are out of their control, are being mistreated. And they were committed to ideals which saw white people in a similar way that they saw them, white people saw them throughout the history of America. James Baldwin understood where these people come from. So I think it's so important for us to understand why they mistreated, hold particular views about those who have mistreated them for so long. But he also was able to see beyond that and commit to the transcendental ideal that the likes of Daniel O'Connell and Martin Luther King and Gandhi committed to, of unifying all of us and realizing that artificial barriers that we create to divide one another should be rejected in any way, and that we should realize the common humanity we all share, our interconnectedness, and stand up to fight for our rights all together, irregardless of who we are and where we come from. And I think when it comes to systemic racism, this spiritual change in the individual and then the access of this individual to the bigger systems can allow us to push the moral arc of our institutions and the moral arc of our systems towards the positive direction of justice. So, yes, this is what I'd like to say.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. I'm not even going to attempt to summarize any of your points, as you were doing so there towards the end yourself. Just this whole importance, I guess, of pushing, of acknowledging the kind of moral climate and the bittersweet dimensions of it, and also then pushing towards kind of commitment for a common humanity. It's a very powerful message, and lots of people have been highlighting the strength of it and how inspiring it is. So thank you very much, Eric, for your contributions this morning. I'm going to move on, though, and I'd like to welcome now Dr. José Roberto Guevara, or Robbie, who's Associate Professor of International Development at RMIT University in Melbourne and a longstanding educator. And Robbie will speak to the role of global citizenship education in tackling inequality. Thanks very much, Robbie.
Thank you very much again for the colleagues for inviting me here to speak. Today, I speak to you from Melbourne, Australia, and so I'm just trying to control, and therefore I acknowledge that I am on the land of the Kulin Nation of the Wurundjeri people, the unceded lands of where we conduct business as a university, but also where I live here in the city of Glen Eira. And I respectfully acknowledge the elders past, present, and emerging as a migrant here in Australia who was embraced as a Filipino who came here as a student more than 20 years ago. And so the work that I do represents the work that I have, or the work that I will speak to represents the work that has been the product of a lot of life-changing experiences for myself. So the truth is that I draw on that experience from other people. And I've been lucky to be able to work in the academe, but also to work in civil society. So I draw from those environments in terms of civil society experiences in the Philippines. And I think, as Amitabh talked about, the Philippines still has Duterte. I was born in the time of martial law. I was born in the time of President Marcos. And so that was a formative experience for me itself. And the experience that Eric talks about in terms of the subtle racism that one experiences when you come to a new country, and the experiences one has as a young gay Asian man in Australia, you can experience those tensions. And so these are the things that are really crucial. And I will invite you, because that's part of the conversation, to be able to reflect on your own global citizenship education, not the education that you were given in schools alone, but the learning how to be global citizenship. Because often when we become educators, we forget our own conscientization processes. We forget, where did this first insight to become an activist come from? What was the core issue that I was fighting for? When we start to talk about pedagogy, then it all of a sudden becomes curriculum. But curriculum, essentially from an adult learning perspective, but even as a teacher, curriculum is life. And we often forget that it's the lives that people live that will inspire them to see the change. Yes, as facilitators, we need to be able to facilitate that, the mirror to show them. But at the same time, I think it's really important for us, if we are to be able to sustain and forge a new path, is to engage with individuals, with communities, with our students, with our learners, in whatever age they might be, to be able to reflect on what is this inequality that they are seeing? Because even if we talk about the realities of inequalities, it is very different in different parts of the world. The realities of COVID are very different in different parts of the world. We have been very lucky in Australia. We're so risk averse. We've just come out of a lockdown in Melbourne, and a lockdown happens when you have 75 people converting into positive across a period of 2 to 3 weeks. So that's a lockdown, okay? Because it's really risk averse. And so we're becoming a closed country. But then it doesn't mean that there isn't inequality that happens here. And so this is the context I haven't gone of what I want to speak with. Have a look at the cover pictures of UNESCO Global Citizenship Education reports. Smiling children, rainbow, all bright, solidarity, color, a focus, completely innocent. Is this the kind of global citizenship that we are actually looking at? When we hear what Amitabh spoke about, when we hear about what Eric spoke about, I really think it's important to have a positive view. But a lot of the focus really is on children. And for us, if we have to have children to become global citizens in the future, we will not have a climate to talk about. We will not have a planet to speak about. Because if that's who we are trying to, and I'm not saying it's not important to start when they are young. But the urgency, the revolutionary times that Eric talks about and that Amitabh talks about, the urgency is now. And then therefore, it is really important for us to be able to, and I speak for looking at as an adult educator, that it is the adults who make decisions. It is the adults who make political decisions. It is adults who vote in elections. Young people, of course, and adults vote in elections. So it is the kind of adult learning that happens not just for young people. And I'm not, again, saying it isn't important to build a generation that will ensure that they continue to have global citizenship as part of the core. But it is the urgency now for us. So if UNESCO calls for target 4.7 in global citizenship education, you cannot have covers that are just about children. And therefore, the next thing I would ask you, therefore, is identify how did you really learn to become a global citizen? Was it a special teacher? Was it a particular experience? What was it that actually shaped you to see yourself as a global citizenship? And again, part of that is what we called about development education. I really think it's important people talk about parents, my mother, traveling as an adult through family and community actions, travel, sports, exchange and traveling, spending time traveling in the global south. Organizations, okay, like Kolama, that met like-minded communities, couch surfing, my parents, travel, okay? And so where is school? And so much of the focus on global citizenship education, I agree. Foundational lessons about global citizenship are developed in schools. If you don't know the world, okay, geography, basic geography of the world, the globe, okay? It's really important. But more than just that, it's the intersection between school and community, the school and the family. And it's this that we need to nurture. If we are committed to global citizenship education, it is these connections that we need to make as global citizenship educators, not just to make for the learners, but to make across each other, linking both formal, non-formal, and informal learning. In trying to define global citizenship education, I would go back to what was already there before. And some people say, oh, it's another kind of education called adjectival education. You must have heard of the Delors pillar. If you haven't had it, it's in 1996. Delors talked about learning to do, to know, to be, and to live together. Okay. And in last few years, they've added to transform oneself in society. Converting this now into COVID times, what did we have to know about COVID? We needed to know about what a virus is and how it's transferred. We needed to know how to do, okay, wash your hands. We needed to be distant, but we still needed to help each other. And a lot of that happened during the COVID times. But more importantly, as Amitabh said, we need to transform the inequalities that we have seen. So COVID, as Amitabh said, is such a potential if we are able to use it effectively. Hence, I'm talking that COVID is the potential to be learning through global citizenship, not for global citizenship, but now in action, where it's not about socially distancing, but it's about being together. It's not just about living together in our safe environments, but cutting across and working across different sectors and transforming ourselves in our society. And so this is the call. This is the call that I make as an educator. Paulo Freire, who celebrates 100 years in September, talked about that in reflecting on how context shapes educational practice, described that the banking method emphasizes permanence and becomes reactionary. And that's the worst kind of education that we want. On the other hand, a problem-posing education, which accepts neither a well-behaved present or a predetermined future, roots itself in the dynamic present. As Eric said, it becomes revolutionary. So we don't just need global citizenship education. We need a different kind of education that actually roots itself both in the formal, in the non-formal, and the informal learning. And we in the adult learning community, in the International Council of Adult Education, have just launched a campaign to call We Are ALE, We Are Adult Learning in Education, that believes that education is a powerful driver for justice, well-being, and change. And I invite you to be part of the campaign. If you believe that we need to have a presence, not just of schooling, but of a different kind of education, then the campaign is there for all of us, and we are ALE. Thanks very much, Elish.
Yeah, fantastic. Thanks very much, Robbie, and superb with time as well. Really powerful calls there for not just global citizenship education, definitely not just for children, for alternative, transformative, critical, radical, revolutionary education at all levels and across all ages. I won't delay any longer, really, because I'm sure lots of people will have lots of points to pull to kind of tease out from what you have said. Thanks very much again, Robbie. And I'd now like to call on Dr. Caroline Mounier. And Caroline is a gender, peace and development specialist and coordinator of Akidwa's Migrant Women Health Programme. And Caroline will speak to what can be done to tackle gender inequality. Thanks very much, Caroline.
Thank you very much, Irish, and thank you very much, IDEA, for calling, for inviting me and to come and speak in this conference. And so I'll go straight to the point, like, what can we do to tackle gender inequality? And I'll also look at, I'll connect that with COVID and what COVID has done to us. And I'll also, more importantly, because I think this is very important for this conference, talk about some of the inequalities which we see here at Akidwa, which I think maybe are going to inform what I'm going to say in the next 7 minutes. And so, like, it's also important that we look at gender and what gender means to us and even to different people, and especially to the migrant woman here in Ireland. And the migrant woman I'm talking about today is the one in the DPs and also the one who is settled, and also the girls and even the boys sometimes who are here. And who, as Eric said, sometimes they face a lot of challenges in their day-to-day lives. And these challenges, even before COVID struck, they were there. There was a gulf, like they were at the bottom of the heap. And so what happened when COVID struck? It widened. Like, what was going wrong before COVID, it was amplified 5 times or 10 times, actually, in some cases. And here, I'll speak to what is happening to some of the women, for example, because I'm also going to look at the SDGs and how achievable they are or attainable, because now COVID-8, that's something to think, we need to think about that. And I'll just put it at the back, parking bay for us just to reflect, like, what do we need to reset the baton and how far and how attainable are SDGs now because of what COVID has thrown in the mix. And so I've said that what was going wrong before COVID, now it's been amplified just 2 times 10. And then let's look at, again, like, what's happening to the women and the challenges and the challenges which are currently present, and they were there. I just want to look at just once more detail of what is going on, for example, because this is what we see when we go to the centers and even the phone calls we get here. Like, no, I've just disconnected the landline so that nobody calls when I'm speaking to you. And For example, just one small thing. We have a lot of women here in the centers who are single mothers. And then these women are already disadvantaged, living in very small rooms with their children, two or three, and then COVID hit, and they had to do homeschooling. What that meant, it exposed the children to a lot of, it showed us the digital divide, because the women, for example, did not have the necessary infrastructure to help their children to study at home. And then that means that already children who are already disadvantaged, who are vulnerable families, they were left behind. There was that lag, for example. We need to look at that lag, that they are not at the same place with the others. So let's also look at this. Let's focus on this as also we think about even global education and global citizenship. What is going to happen to these children already? Because now you can see they are already 1 year behind, 6 months behind, 9 months behind, and we want them to compete at an even keel, and I'm sorry to use that word, at an even level with the others. So I'll not give an answer to that because I want us to think about that. And then for us to move from what is going on, even in gender equality, development, because sometimes they have to come together, we cannot leave one behind. How much are we willing as we move from COVID, as we move from the COVID situation and as we forge a new path, how much are we willing to consult those people who are already disadvantaged, who are already vulnerable? Because I know when you talk about power, we forget that power, actually, it's not even sometimes been about giving it. No, sometimes we don't need to give anybody any power. We just need to recognize and to acknowledge the power the other person has. Because I come from a development education, the one the last speaker was talking about, which recognizes that everybody, no matter how disadvantaged, no matter where they live, no matter where they are, that they have power. What you need to do is just to acknowledge it and be patient enough and bring it out and talk to somebody in such a way that which will acknowledge and respect that. And that person will start slowly by slowly coming alive and saying, this is what I'd like, and drawing a small picture. It may not be perfect, but that picture will be drawn about what they would like and where they would like to go. So as we reset the button, how willing are we? To look at power, to look at different types of power, acknowledge them so that we can bring the best out of everybody. So that also we can ask the people which direction they would like to move towards, and even how they would like. And because I think that would be something important for us to address. And I think I have now 3 minutes. And I feel that will keep the sense of global citizenship alive. And then education. I've given an example of those children who are already behind. A rights-based recovery, that is very, very important. And I also remember what the first speaker said, that the UDHR was one of the bestest gifts we were ever given. And there's no time to call for that, to emphasize on the UDHR and that roadmap which you are given, and then also the other conventions and human rights observers which have come to being and which speak directly to the rights of women and girls. There's no better time than now. And then we marry that with the SDGs, and I know that we'll end up to a very, very beautiful direction, and a very good outcome will be realized. And because I'm also conscious of the fact that sometimes we may talk about these things here when we are in these spaces with idea, but the people who are most affected may not know about them. I'm also conscious of the fact that I cannot go maybe to the village or where I used to work in Kenya before I came here and start telling them about SDGs, because they may not even know what that is. Maybe the language and other things may not. But we all know, Erish, you taught me, there are ways we can employ, and that this message will reach people who are far, very far away from us. And with this and that distance, maybe we may look at distance as maybe be to 10,000 kilometers. But sometimes distance can be also in terms of knowledge, those who are already here. And and they don't know, and the awareness has not been created. We look up, we come up with ways to bridge that, and that would be lovely, and that is something which maybe we can consider as we look at how we can support a rights-based recovery that ensures equality for everyone. And so I think I want to thank you, and maybe I'll stop there, and thank you very much.
Brilliant, Caroline. Thanks so much. I was so busy writing down what you were saying there. I got caught there at the end. A really powerful reminder of the importance of ensuring that those who are most affected by COVID, but also existing kind of marginalization and disadvantage and discrimination, are at the heart of decision making and processes around critical global citizenship education and activism for change. And so it's, I suppose, ensuring a rights-based recovery is a key kind of message that has come out from what you have said. So many really important points that all of you have made. And I'm really struck by, I suppose, the need for change, the points that you've highlighted about not ignoring or diminishing in any way the challenges that people have faced, in particular this year, but acknowledging that many of them have been amplified, exacerbated or highlighted by COVID. And the need for a kind of a radical alternative forms of education, including new forms of global citizenship education that put rights and equality and justice at the heart of them. So I'd really like to thank you for your really inspiring and very interesting and challenging points that you've made. So thanks very much for that.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy this episode. Don't forget to check out our website for more. Until the next time.